I'm Mikhail Burley. I teach in the Theology and Religious Studies department, as does Rachel. And amongst the areas of religious studies that I teach are Hindu traditions, and forthcomingly I'll be teaching some a course on Buddhism as well. I also do research on what I just generally call philosophy of religion. I've got some background in sort of philosophical approaches to the study of religion, as well as what gets called religious studies. And I was invited, I was kindly invited to participate in this conference in order, I presume, to offer an alternative perspective on the treatment of animals, so from a different religious perspective, perspective other than that of Christianity. And the most obvious one for me would be to look at something from the Hindu traditions. Now, looking at treatment of animals within Hindu traditions is not something I'd looked at specifically before. So I opted to have a look at a particular text that I was interested in, and that's what I'll be talking about. And I'll be relying on quite heavily on my script and the PowerPoint here. Now, if I was going to stand up, but am I blocking the lowest part of that? No. Okay. Right. The religious traditions that are grouped together under the term Hinduism have had a long and complicated relationship with principles concerning the treatment of animals. Thus, it would be foolhardy to try to provide a comprehensive overview in a single paper. What I intend to do for the most part is to focus on a selection of especially pertinent textual sources and to discuss various implications that they have for a Hindu understanding of sacrifice, non-violence, and abstention from meat. Is there some way of... it's gone.
You need to turn it on and off
the box. Don't want to stand on a chair and hit that.
Can I stand on your chair?
Yes.
Maybe if it's going to take a little while, I'll continue, but obviously I've got slides to accompany it.
As far as the bloke told me, that should do the job. I'm just going to press all the buttons now.
There we go.
The green light has gone off.
It's still going on the bulb and electricity.
There's two of them there.
It just would have been.
Sorry, Michael. If you want to carry on. Oh, it's turned on again, I think, so you should get it.
Okay.
Even the threat of swearing, if it were, then. It was.
The main,
thank you very much.
They're not absolutely essential. They probably won't add a great deal, but the main text that I want to discuss comes from the great epic poem known as the Mahabharata. The Mahabharata, as many of you may know, is vast. Its total length extends to around 100,000 verses, divided into 18 books, several of which comprise over 100 chapters each. So I'm not going to be talking about much of it. The part that I'll be focusing on comes from the 13th book, which is known as the Anushasana Parabam. I mean, I'm going to be using some Sanskrit terms, so that was one reason. Oh, it's come back, right. The Anushasana Parabhan, or Book of Teachings. I also need to, if I stand here, that's alright, isn't it? So I'm not shifting over to the buttons. Before coming to that, however, let me provide a little historical background. First, it will be helpful to say something about the ancient Vedic religion, which constitutes one of the main sources of later Hinduism. Estimates vary widely about when and where the Vedic religion originated, but a few things are generally agreed upon. For instance, that by around 1200 BCE, the Vedic religion was prevalent in the north of the Indian subcontinent, and that it spread throughout the subcontinent over the several hundred years subsequent to that, becoming intermingled with pre-existing religious traditions in such a way as to eventually produce the colourful and complex mixture that we call Hinduism. The Vedic religion is so called because its principal teachings and practices were compiled in texts known as the Vedas. Veda meaning roughly vision or knowledge. The interesting thing with regards to the treatment of animals is that Vedic religious rituals often included animal sacrifice, and the consumption of animal flesh, including beef, appears to have been commonplace in Vedic society. One of the ways in which Vedic cosmologies divide up the universe was in terms of the categories of eater and eaten, or consumer and consumed. Thus, in the Vedic text known as the Shatapatha Brahmana, roughly 1500 BCE, we don't know exactly, it is stated that plants and trees are the food of fire, water is the food of wind or air, the moon is the food of the sun, and animals are the food of human beings. So you've got sort of symbolism mixed in with something that could be taken quite literally. Commenting on this passage, the Sanskrit scholar Brian Smith writes that man's power over the animals and his culinary appreciation of their savouriness is thus set in a macrocosmic context of alimentary violence. In later Hindu traditions, the principle of ahimsa, which can be translated as non-harming or non-violence, became a generalised ideal, as did a largely or exclusively meat-free diet. Why, we might ask, did this transition from the older Vedic religion occur? Various theories have been suggested, but the most common is that the Vedic religion, which evolved into mainstream Hinduism, often called Brahmanical Hinduism, became increasingly influenced by renouncer traditions, as they're known. As the French scholar Louis Dumont puts it, vegetarianism forced itself on Hindu society, having begun in the sects of the renouncers, among which are Jainism and Buddhism. This remark should be qualified, however, by noting firstly that the shift away from meat consumption appears to have preceded the burgeoning of Jainism and Buddhism, which happened around the 4th century BCE, and secondly that although there were certainly precepts against the slaughter of animals by Buddhist monastics, the acceptance of offerings of meat by such monastics was rarely condemned. Jainism, meanwhile, does appear to have been stricter in these respects, but vegetarianism wasn't necessarily widespread within early Buddhism. From 500 or 400 BCE onwards, orthodox Brahmanical texts on social and religious norms, known as Dharma Sutras and Dharma Shastras, place the principles of non-violence and abstention from meat among the most salient criteria for determining a person's spiritual purity, and hence also his or her social status. As a general rule, the distance of one's occupation from the killing of humans and animals was indicative of one's position in the social and cosmic hierarchy. Within that is the bewilderingly recondite class and caste systems. This general rule was made more complicated by two notable facts. Firstly, there was the fact that animal sacrifice continued to play an important role in Hindu religious worship well into the Dharmashastra period. And those who performed these sacrifices came from the Brahmana class, which was indisputably regarded as the most spiritually pure of the four main social classes. Secondly, there was the fact that the second purest class, the Kshatriyas, comprising rulers and warriors, professions associated with hunting animals for food and sport, and obviously with warfare and violence. These two facts generate an awkward tension that ripples through various traditions of Hinduism, and which manifests from time to time in some central Hindu texts. This is where the Anushasana Paravan of the Mahabharata becomes especially relevant, for it is among a small number of ancient and highly authoritative Hindu texts that deal in an explicit and relatively sustained manner with the questions of animal sacrifice and eating meat. While I'm doubtful that the text fully resolves the tensions I've noted, it does make some intriguing and significant suggestions. Among other things, the text contains dialogues between a king named Yudhishthira and two important teachers. The first of these teachers is a deva, a divine being or shining one, whose name Brihaspati translates roughly as Lord of Prayer. The second is the great uncle of Yudhishthira, named Bhishma, who raised him along with his four brothers and who is a renowned expert in warfare. Following the central battle of the Mahabharata epic, Bhishma now lies dying of numerous arrow wounds, yet he's nevertheless able to respond at considerable length to Yudhishthira's requests for guidance. The guidance that Yudhishthira seeks concerns the relative merits of various forms of spiritual or ethical practice, and he's especially eager to know how to fulfil his dharma, that is, his religious and moral duty, in a way that is consistent with traditional norms. In the figures of Brihaspati and Bhishma, we see represented the authority of divine power and ancestral heritage, respectively, and the replies that these two figures provide complement one another in interesting ways. Bhishma's discourse is longer than that of Brihaspati's and contains far more elaboration of the principles of sacrifice and abstention from meat. Brihaspati, however, makes some intriguing proposals concerning non-violence more generally, and hence it will be useful to examine his discourse before coming to Bhishma's. One depiction of Brihaspati there from some traditional source. In his opening question to Brihaspati, Yudhishthira lists six forms of spiritual or ethical practice and asks which of them is the best for a person to undertake. The forms of practice are the following. Ahimsa, which, as I noted before, can be translated as non-harming or non-violence. Vaidikam karma, which means the performance of Vedic sacrifice or Vedic rituals. Spiritual meditation or contemplation. Restraint of the senses. Performance of austerities or ascetic practice. And service to one's teacher or guru. A couple of points are worth noting immediately. Firstly, the second of these practices, the performance of Vedic rituals, may reasonably be assumed to include animal sacrifice, and hence on the face of it to be incompatible with the first. By placing ahimsa and Vedic ritual next to each other like this, the author of the text appears to be inviting consideration of the relation between them. The remaining four practices are relatively uncontroversial by comparison and are certainly not mutually incompatible. The second noteworthy fact is that most of these forms of practice are traditionally more closely associated with male Hindus belonging to the Brahmana or priestly class than to the Kshatriya or warrior class, to which Yudhishthira, the question asker, belongs. It is those who are relatively aloof from everyday social activities, the Brahmana scholars or priests, who are able to maintain the vow of non-harming, not those whose class position requires them to take up arms in defence of the kingdom. And although wealthy Kshatriyas may sponsor the performance of elaborate Vedic rituals, the performance itself is conducted by Brahmana priests. In responding to Yudhishthira's question, the god Brihaspati begins by affirming that all six of the aforementioned practices are efficacious doors to dharma, where dharma can be understood as the right way to act and live, the way that is in harmony with the cosmic order. He then proceeds to focus almost exclusively on the first, namely ahimsa, albeit in a way that connects it with broader spiritual themes. In particular, he links it with the relinquishing of personal desire, and with the submergence of one's individuality within a more universal identity. That man, declares Brihaspati, who performs the dharma of non-violence to all beings, achieves or fulfills goodness. This, he adds, requires restraining both desire and aversion. and cultivating a high degree of fellow feeling with all creatures. The man who regards all creatures as his self, he continues, suppressing anger and laying aside the rod, achieves sukha. Sukha being a term denoting a wide range of positive states of happiness or well-being. It's always, at least implicitly, the opposite of dukkha, which is suffering, distress, or dissatisfactoriness. The latter term, dukkha, is frequently used to designate that which is to be escaped from or eradicated, according to Hindu soteriology. The salvific goal is a release from the ongoing cycle of births and deaths, which cycle is held to be ineliminably pervaded by dukkha. The ultimate sukha, therefore, would obtain only when the spiritual self transcends the wheel of reincarnations. It is thus noteworthy that non-violence and the dissolution of barriers, both ethical and ontological, between oneself and other creatures, are conceived as intimately connected with soteriological aspiration and attainment, spiritual liberation. There is, we might say, a mutual entailment between renunciation of the self and renunciation of violence. As the Mahabharata scholar Alf Hilterbeitel observes, ahimsa bears the ascetic imprint of the desire not to kill or harm creatures, which in its ascetic framework is a desire to overcome the desire for life. The desire to overcome the desire for life. The motivation for non-violence in epic Hinduism is, then, difficult to characterise straightforwardly. One might be tempted to regard it as instrumental, insofar as refraining from violence is viewed as a means to releasing oneself from further suffering. In this respect, the motivation appears to be self-centred rather than other-directed, and hence to preclude the virtues of pity or compassion. But given that the release from suffering involves a dissolution of one's very individual selfhood, the motivation can hardly be construed as self-serving. Indeed, the cultivation of non-violence appears to stem from an impulse that many Christians, for example, might see as going too far in the direction of self-abnegation and away from the imperative to love the other as one's self. Brihaspati seems to allude to the difficulty of understanding the kind of relation to the other that is intended here when he remarks enigmatically that even the gods who desire a fixed abode are bewildered at the path of the one who looks upon all creatures as his own self, leaving no trace behind. The suggestion here is that the gods, like the vast majority of us, desire to retain some sense of differentiation between themselves and others, some fixed abode, and cannot comprehend the path of the one in whom that desire is absent. The immediately succeeding verse in the text is one that some translators have been tempted to read as expressing the golden rule, some version of it, whose classical formulation we find in Christ's injunction to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Kesari Mohan Ganguly's translation from the 1890s has been especially influential in this regard, and he renders the verse as follows. This verse from the Mahabharata. One should never do that to another which one regards as injurious to one's own self. This, in brief, is the rule of righteousness, of dharma. One, by acting in a different way, by yielding to desire, becomes guilty of unrighteousness. Slightly ungrammatical in the translation there. The aptness of this translation is, however, contentious, as can be seen if we compare it with an alternative one by another translator named Christopher Chappell. A bit more concise. From not holding the other as opposite to oneself, there is the essence of dharma. The other proceeds as other due to desire. A very different translation. In this latter rendering, the emphasis is not obviously ethical, or at least the practical implications of the verse are left underdeveloped. Instead, what is contended is that the very perception of a distinction between self and other can be resisted, and that it is in the negation of this distinction that Dharma consists. Exactly what modes of action are expected to follow from the diminution and ultimate elimination of the perceptual or perceived ontological distinction are left unstated. Given that the verse under discussion occurs within the context of an elaboration of the practice of non-violence, it may seem reasonable to assume that there is a strong implicit link between ontology and ethics here. That is, one may be liable to assume that the injunction to subsume self and other under a unitary principle entails the extinguishing of animosity between individuals, which in turn entails the cessation of both actual and possible possible violence. This may well be so, and it is certainly one legitimate reading of the text, a reading that has, as we have seen, guided the way in which Ganguly, for one, translates the verse. An equally legitimate reading, however, would view the injunction to dissolve the distinction between self and other as calling for a radical revision of our ordinary concepts, including our ethical concepts, such that the very notion of what counts as a violent act, and hence the very meaning of violence itself, is transformed. A poignant precedent for such a transformation of concepts is provided in the discourse between Krishna and Arjuna that occurs in the earlier part of the Mahabharata, known as the Bhagavad Gita. When the warrior prince Arjuna, brother of Yudhishthira, questions the wisdom of participating in a fratricidal war, the divine Krishna, incarnation of God Vishnu, responds not by encouraging him to renounce violence, but by enjoining him to transcend the earthbound perspective from which death is seen as something terrible and final, upon realizing that the same eternal and indestructible essence underlies all of us, Krishna declares, we will come to see death's relative insignificance. At one place, the author of the Gita puts into Krishna's mouth a verse from the Katha Upanishad, which exclaims that both killing and death are merely apparent. Who believes him a slayer, Krishna asserts, and who thinks him slain, both these understand not. He slays not, he's not slain. The subject of this verse is the eternal self, or being, that transcends any particular incarnation. From this eternal perspective, it is merely the bodily forms that are destroyed. And since these forms have no intrinsic value, Arjuna ought not to worry that thousands of them are likely to be slaughtered in the impending battle. The Gita thus appeals to a unitary ontological principle in order to validate a shift in our conception of killing and death, and does so in a way that may leave us wondering whether ethics has any place in the new conception. Of course, there are multiple competing interpretations of the Gita, and I haven't got time to go into that. Mahatma Gandhi, for one, made some very interesting interpretations of it in line with his own non-violent stance. In order to examine these issues surrounding the meaning of non-violence in the Mahabharata further, I will now turn to the exchange between Yudhishthira and Bhishma, which immediately follows that between Yudhishthira and Brihaspati, which I mentioned before. It is there that we find, among other things, a strengthening of the connection between non-violence and abstention from meat, but also a problematizing of that connection. When Yudhishthira comes to his grandsire Bhishma for further advice, the latter is lying on his deathbed, shot with arrows from Prince Arjuna's bow, as it happens. Given Bhishma's status as a great warrior, it may be surprising that Yudhishthira turns to him for instruction on how someone who has committed violence in thought, speech and deed, as he puts it, may free himself from the misery of dukkha that ensues from such actions, dukkha being that dissatisfactory kind of life that I noted before. Yet Bhishma, at the end of his life, ably plays the role of the wise sage, lying on what is described as a bed of arrows. His image constitutes an extreme version of the ascetic who lies upon a bed of nails or spikes. or, I don't know whether this is stretching the point, or the martyr pierced by arrows of a deluded and merciless world. Sebastian. Here I will just pick out for consideration a selection of the most interesting remarks from his discourse, Bhishma's discourse. To illustrate the importance of ahimsa, Bhishma uses two animal-related images. First, he says, not altogether accurately perhaps, that just as four-legged animals are unable to stand on only three legs, so the dharma, the duty of non-violence, can stand only if all four of its feet are in place. From the context of the remark, it appears that, echoing the form of Yudhishthira's question, three of these feet are respectively non-violence in thought, word, and deed. What the fourth foot or mode of non-violence consists in remains unclear. Later in the discourse, an example of violence in thought is provided when Bhishma remarks that one who approves of slaughter is stained with sin, even as is the one who actually performs it. Bhishma also includes purchasing meat as a form of violence. The second animal-related image that Bhishma uses is that of an elephant's footprint. Just as it engulfs those of all other animals, so ahimsa encompasses all other dharmas, or forms of righteousness. On this account, then, non-violence is the highest duty, yet it remains to be seen exactly what it amounts to in practical terms. Interestingly, having emphasised the ethical centrality of non-violence, Bhishma's exposition of what it involves begins with reference to the abstention from meat. He characterises such abstention as a kind of spiritually purifying austerity, noting that the flesh of animals is like that of one's own son, and that, to use another image, just as the union of mother and father produces offspring, so the union of flavour and tongue produces sensual attachment. This attachment to the world and one's own individual life is conceived as the opposite of spiritual development, which consists in freeing the mind from the desire for sensory gratification. And the desire for the taste of flesh is cited here as epitomising such attachment. Bhishma questions how those slow or stupid, as he puts it, slow or stupid individuals who eat meat will be able to hear the divine music of drums, cymbals and conch shells. This being a reference to the sort of spontaneous sonic experience that is common to traditional Indian descriptions of heightened spiritual awareness. At the end of the first part of his discourse, Bhishma contrasts those who consume meat with those holy individuals who are willing to sacrifice their own flesh to protect that of others, and who thereby go to the divine realm. The second part of the dialogue between Yudhishthira and Bhishma begins with Yudhishthira asking a series of questions, one of which concerns the vexed issue of the relation between non-violence and the performance of traditional sacrificial rites. He especially wants to know how meat offerings, which are intrinsic to the performance of ceremonies designed to honour the ancestral fathers, may be procured without violating the prohibition against killing. Bhishma's initial response is to declare the killing of animals for sacrificial purposes to be laudable. He specifically mentions the horse sacrifice, the Ashwamedha, noting that the monthly performance of this ritual is equivalent to the renunciation of meat and honey, equivalent in some sort of spiritually purifying sense. Six verses later, he repeats that these two forms of discipline are equivalent, adding that one who abstains from meat is or becomes one who always performs sacrifices, always offers gifts, always undergoes austerities. The implication here is again that there is, in religious terms, an equivalence between these things. These responses echo the reply that Brihaspati gave to Yudhishthira when asked which of six forms of ethico-religious practice is most meritorious. Of those six forms, there is no mention in Bhishma's discourse of meditation or the restraint of the senses, But Bhishma's suggestion of an equivalence between abstention from meat, ritual sacrifice, gift giving, and austerities reiterates Brihaspati's pronouncement that each of these practices is a doorway to Dharma. The proposal that animal sacrifice is consistent with ahimsa is one that extends back at least as far as the Chandogya Upanishad, which is usually dated to between 800 and 500 BCE. At the very end of that text, we read that he who centers all the senses in the self, who practices non-violence ahimsa to all beings except at holy places, tirtha, who behaves thus throughout his life, reaches the Brahma world, and thus does not return here again, and does not return here again, transcends the cycle of rebirths. The implication here is that harming animals is acceptable, provided it is carried out as part of a ritual act at a sacred location. It is interesting that there appears to be an acknowledgement that the ritual slaughter does indeed harm the animal. The claim is not that by virtue of being carried out at a holy site, the killing of an animal ceases to be a harmful act. Rather, it is that the harming of animals is permissible at holy sites. There are no doubt other traditional Hindu texts that would problematise that claim, but that's what it seems to be implied here. The subsequent passage in Bhishma's discourse with Yudhishthira in the Mahabharata, though endorsing the view that killing is permissible in those cases where the sacrificial animal has been ritually consecrated, maintains that such acts of killing are not entirely free from fault. To do otherwise, Bhishma adds, is to defile oneself, although it isn't entirely clear from the context whether by doing otherwise he means merely refraining from performing the sacrifice, or alternatively actively killing animals that have not been consecrated. In any case, there appears to be an admission in this passage, as in the one from the Chandogya Upanishad, that even under the conditions of religious ritual, the killing of an animal is not a spiritually or ethically pure act. We might perhaps say that it involves a compromise between the principle of ahimsa on the one hand and the commitment to honour the ancestors or the gods on the other. The notion of purity is complex here, however. For once the animal has been sanctified, its flesh is considered pure, and hence edible without the risk of committing any further impure act. Manu himself, writes the author of Bhishma's discourse, has declared that that which is sanctification by sacred mantras in accordance with Vedic liturgy and performed in honour of the fathers, or Pitras, is pure. Manu being the primordial legislator of each new cosmic age, the legendary figure to whom is attributed authorship of the Manava Dharma Shastra, or Laws of Manu. While admitting that consuming unsanctified meat is to behave like a demonic rakshasa, Bhishma states that no such proscription obtains with respect to richly purified meat. Later in the discourse, Bhishma goes so far as to pronounce that animals were created for the purpose of sacrifice, and that this is affirmed in the Vedic teachings, which were directly heard by the sages of old. Okay, just some concluding remarks now. Notwithstanding then the principle of non-violence, upon which both Brihaspati and Bhishma laid great stress, and Bhishma's emphasis on abstention from meat in his elaboration of that principle, the legitimacy of traditional Vedic sacrifice is not substantially challenged in the Anushasana Parvam. At least this is how things appear on the surface. However, by repeatedly placing non-violence and abstention from meat on a level with the performance of sacrifice, the author or authors of the text do effectively dethrone sacrifice from its once privileged status as the highest of all religious practices. This opens up the possibility of reconceptualizing sacrifice itself, which reconceptualization we find carried out to some extent in, for example, the Bhagavad Gita, where in several passages an inner or psychological sacrifice is more highly esteemed than the external sacrifice associated with the Vedas. Once renunciation of the self, of one's own desire for worldly grandeur and enjoyment, is conceived as a form of sacrifice, at least equivalent in spiritual value to the offering of sanctified animals to the ancestors or gods, the social need for Vedic sacrifice is diminished. Of course, not everyone can withdraw sufficiently from the throng of worldly activity to be able to pursue a path of complete non-violence. And hence, it would be misleading to interpret a text such as the Anushasana Paravan as a subversion of Brahmana authority in spiritual matters. But in the extolling of abstention from meat as a paradigm of non-violent practice, the discourse of Bhishma in this text does contribute towards a general transformation of dietary attitudes, according to which the consumption of unsanctified meat is regarded as spiritually polluting. More generally, the Mahabharata and the Dharmashastras can be seen as part of a prolonged and multi-layered transition period in the history of Hindu social and religious norms, a period in which the prevalence of Vedic ritual diminishes, to be complemented, or in some instances replaced, by a veneration of world-renouncing ideals. This trend away from Vedic ritual practices continued subsequent to the epic period, until, in contemporary Hinduism, sacrificial rites are rarely, if ever, performed on a grand scale. Vegetarianism is widespread, and the consumption of beef in particular is virtually universally condemned. Indicative of the general change of mood in contemporary Hinduism is the fact that when the Vedic fire ritual, known as the Agni Chayana, was re-enacted in the South Indian state of Kerala in 1975, disputes over the proposed sacrifice of 14 goats resulted in rice cakes wrapped in banana leaves being used as offerings instead. Where animal sacrifice is still carried out, it is usually in connection with non-Vedic worship of the goddess in her bloodthirsty, ferocious forms such as Durga, or especially Kali, one depiction being shown here. These associations of goddess worship with animal sacrifice are complex and fascinating, but our consideration of them must await another occasion.
Do we have any questions?
Did you want to chair, or shall I pick people out for myself?
Oh, you can.
If there's no questions, it won't be any problem. Yep.
I mean, I don't know much about, you know, what you've been talking about before, but there seems to be a similar time span between the ancient Hindu teachings of the Vedic and the ancient Israelites. Do you think there could be any connection between the Vedic teachings on the sacrifice and the Levite sacrifice?
Mm-hmm. What sort of connection are you thinking of? What sort of actual transmission or communication or shared religious practices of some sort?
Communication, maybe, because the Levites were very much into animal sacrifice. Mm. A similar time frame. I wondered if there's any evidence that there is any kind of communication between the two.
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, it's not an area that I have great expertise in. That particular comparison. But I'm not aware of evidence of. I'm not aware of any strong evidence of communication between those religious traditions, but. The predominant theory about how the Vedic religion was introduced into India It's been highly contested, especially in recent decades, but still the predominant view is that it was imported from outside and from the very roughly speaking sort of Central and Western Asian region. The notion of an Aryan people from those early times, which spread out in multiple directions, including to India and westwards towards what we call the Middle East now, is a very, very popular theory. I mean, it's based on pretty loose linguistic, mostly on linguistic evidence, you know, shared forms within the languages from those times, and we don't have a lot of solid evidence concerning even the languages from those early, particularly sort of pre-1000 BCE times. But short answer is, it's very likely there was some kind of communication going on. I wouldn't go so far as to say it was a shared religious tradition, but these common forms, I think fascinating connections, yeah.
Would there not have been trading boats going from India to Egypt, possibly going through Jerusalem, and overland moves through Jerusalem?
Yeah, I mean, it depends what period we are thinking of. There have been, you know, the history of India is long and complex, and one view is that some of the earliest settlers within India came by boat, you know, even pre-Aryan civilization, pre-Vedic religion. But again, I think the short answer is yes, there would have been some communication via sea routes as well as overland. I wouldn't really want to hazard from which period onwards. In trading, I think, was probably going on primarily overland up to just a few hundred years BCE rather than right back in the early Vedic period. But I'm guessing.
Again, I don't have much particular knowledge in this area either. Would it be a fair comparison to draw between the kind of neat abstention that you're seeing in the epic you were talking about and the kind of asceticism that you see in the early desert fathers, Chris, in the 3rd, 4th centuries CE, in that it was a avoidance of meat practiced for reasons relating to the individual's spirituality, a concern for the animal, life as an individual is not necessarily there at that stage. Because that seems quite different to what I understand of Hinduism now, where there is more. Is that accurate?
Right, so the main point is sort of highlighting another commonality, I suppose, isn't it? That was your initial point within these ascetic forms of spirituality. And I think certainly it's a feature of the two traditions that we've mentioned, Desert Fathers, as you say, and this sort of ascetic trend, theme, strand running through Hindu traditions. And yes, as I endeavoured to highlight, the associations, the connections with a sort of ethical concern for the animals is very difficult to tease out. Certainly there's a strong concern with one's own spiritual purity, and that seems uppermost. That seems to be sort of paramount. And yet, if the killing of animals wasn't in some way ethically bad, in what sense would it be an impure act to kill and eat them? I think these questions are sort of tightly bound up with one another. And there's a sense in which, in some of these traditions, we might have to be very cautious about approaching them with a distinction between the spiritual and the ethical already in our minds, and try to examine the motivations without immediately trying to divide them into those categories. I think it's a complicated matter.
And I don't think you mentioned reincarnation beliefs, but surely that impinges on the value of eating meat or killing animals.
Yeah, it certainly does, and I did mention it once or twice, but not I didn't focus heavily on it. No, I mean, that comes in with respect to this notion of a sort of ongoing process of spiritual purification of the, not so much of the sort of embodied personal human being that I am, but rather something more abstract, like this spiritual essence that is supposed to continue on from one life to another. And that it's that that, and then it's difficult to know how to express the point, because in some places it's expressed in terms of that, you know, already being entirely pure, that the task is to realize that that's our true identity. But in another sense, there's a sort of ongoing process of purification which requires multiple lifetimes to continue to fulfill. And so for, you know, talking about Hinduism is difficult because it's such a vast period of time that I'm talking about here, but thinking about contemporary Hindus, for example, and I didn't really address Matthew's point about sort of contemporary Hinduism, but thinking about Hindus in the contemporary world, they might well be looking to improve themselves in order, and they might put it in terms of gaining a more auspicious rebirth. You know, rather than in the ascetic traditions, the goal is to go all out for ultimate spiritual liberation in this lifetime and to never be reborn. But for most Hindus, sort of lay Hindus living in a worldly existence, not taking vows of renunciation, living an ascetic life, their spiritual goal might well be expressed in terms of obtaining a better rebirth the next time round, which will sort of put them in a stronger position for then making progress and further progress towards purification.
That's somehow at the expense of animals that may have been sacrificed in cases. Sorry, I'm just trying to grapple with this idea of a cycle of being.
Yeah.
Are we understanding some parts of the cycle of being are sacrificed for the benefit of the whole?
Right, yeah, so you're thinking of the role that animal sacrifice has within that
ongoing.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, when I was making that point just now, I wasn't thinking so much of animal sacrifice playing a part in that. I mean, as I said, it's very rare these days. So contemporary Hindus would be thinking of, they might well put their practice of vegetarian diet in the context of sort of spiritual purification, which is aimed towards obtaining a more auspicious rebirth. The connections between animal sacrifice and reincarnation are complex because in the early Vedic religion, the belief in reincarnation wasn't firmly in place. It's very sort of controversial whether it was there at all. So there they were looking more towards pleasing the gods or pleasing the ancestors so that they might ascend to a kind of heavenly existence. It's messy and complicated.
I've got time for one more. Rachel
and...
I can talk to the Pope.
Right, how many hands have we got up then? I don't know who was first. But there's two, just two.
Fine.
Quick, two quick ones. Oh, and there's you asked one already, so you get put to the bottom, I'm afraid.
It's very short.
Okay, well, we'll see. Matt's the arbiter here.
Yeah.
Do you want to go for it first? Yeah.
It's an area that I was almost entirely ignorant of, and as you were speaking, I was struggling to find a framework to hold together what you were saying. The closest I could come up with is a kind of dialogic framework. Mm-hmm. Now, is that just because I don't understand it, or is it inherently anti-totalizing?
A dialogic framework. What were you seeking to put into a dialogic framework?
For example, at one point you gave an instance which appeared to be undercut any possibility of ethics, but then at a later stage there was obviously a very strong ethical element present, and it seemed that there was a dialogue going on between these different and other strands too.
Sure. Yeah. I was to some extent sort of picking out things that I found interesting and not meshing them all together. I mean, the notion of dialogue is there in the texts that I was looking at. They are dialogues. They're dialogues between a spiritual seeker, one who's seeking spiritual knowledge or the right way to live, on the one hand, and somebody that's in the position of a guru, someone who's got the status to be able to impart some knowledge, wisdom of that sort. But the kind of knowledge that's imparted becomes very, very complicated and difficult to interpret, partly because it's one of the reasons for this is that these texts, it's very likely they were composed over not just decades but probably hundreds of years, though they might well have had material added to them, and hence you get things that appear to be inconsistent or at least in tension with one another within the same texts. And I don't know that I can put it all in one large framework for you, but there are these ongoing dialogues within the texts, between individual characters within the texts, and yeah, I think if you were suggesting that there's a kind of dialogue going on between texts, you know, different parts within the Mahabharata as a whole epic, I think that's going on as well. Sort of parts of the tradition responding to earlier parts and trying to bring into some kind of compatibility aspects of an extremely complex tradition that I think straightforwardly does have internal contradictions.
And is that inherent, do you think, to the vision itself? That it can't be any other way than that?
I'm not quite sure what to say there. I mean, I approach the text as it is, rather than seeking to find what its essence might be. To say that whether it's inherent or intrinsic, and that it couldn't be any other way, might be implying that there's a sort of essential message there, which it might be my task as an interpreter to find. But that's not how I'd approach it. So. Short answer would be no. I don't think it's inherent.
Okay.
I might have misunderstood the point of the question.
One last very quick question.
That was the lady there.
It wasn't really a question. It's just a comment. I've listened a couple of times to a Vegetarian Society speaker who's of Indian origin. Now I don't know how religious he was, but I mean, a point he kept making was about a circle of compassion, and that that meat eaters generally just include other human beings in a circle, but for vegetarians it's wider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a circle or a sphere, you know, is extending the one's moral sensibility outwards. And are you sort of asking, is that something that's commonplace within perhaps Hindu traditions or Buddhism? I think, I'd give the short answer that within contemporary Hindu traditions that may well be a common way of expressing the thought. One can find multiple ways of expressing the point within Hinduism, and I think many of them have been these days influenced by sort of ethical perspectives from other cultures. To take one example, Gandhi himself was very strongly influenced by the work of Tolstoy, to give one example, and also Jainism, the Jain tradition within India, at least as much, if not more so, than by his own Hindu background.
In fact, what he said was that when he came to England as a young man, he'd been brought up vegetarian. He came to England as a young man, and then he's, everybody's eating meat. I suppose I better join the British culture and eat meat. And so he found a work colleague who was vegan, and thought, I better go back to my, the ethical tradition I'm used to.
Yes, it was kind of rediscovery for him of something that was already there to be found in. Yeah.